Coffee in Space is a podcast by S. Daniel Smith that puts the best in established and up-and-coming science fiction and fantasy writers in front of you, their readers. Dan's goal is to help you learn more about who they are as people, how they write, and how they live. Whether you're listening to this podcast at home, or in your car, or somewhere in between, Dan hopes to transport you to the crew lounge on an intergalactic spaceship, where you can have a cup of your favorite coffee with science fiction and fantasy authors. So sit back, listen in, and enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, this is Dan Smith. I'm a big science fiction fan and a heavy coffee drinker. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 13 of Coffee in Space. William H. Keith, author of over 100 books, is here to talk today about his newest book, Alien Secrets, published this week by Harper Voyager. William, thanks for joining us, and thanks for having Coffee in Space with us today.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Make mine with cream and sugar.
Ah, that's exactly how I take it, actually. Good to know we have that in common. Well, Bill, start by telling us a little about Alien Secrets. What's the synopsis?
Okay, there needs a little bit of explanation. There is, within the murky world of UFO conspiracy theories, a narrative about something called Solar Warden. In 2001, early 2002, a British hacker named Gary McKinnon claimed to have broken into 97 U.S. Military and NASA computers. He was looking for any evidence for free energy. And what he claimed to have found was evidence for this top secret U.S. military space program, which is called Solar Warden. According to this narrative, we were able to successfully reverse engineer wreckage found at Roswell and spaceships collected elsewhere. We've developed our own anti-gravity drive. We have faster than light drive. It all sounds pretty Star Trek. So Alien Secrets makes the assumption, well, what if all of this is true? If Gary McKinnon is absolutely honest and sane in what he's saying. So we have treaties with several extra solar civilizations. Right now, this moment, according to this theory, we have a space fleet in orbit and bases on the moon and so on. It's very much Star Trek. The central character of the series is a U.S. Navy SEAL named Mark Hunter. He and his team are recruited into Solar Warden and begin forming a direct action team that's stationed aboard one of these high-tech spacecraft carriers, a mothership. And it's called the USS... How many S's? USSS, Hillencoder. And in the course of the first book, they deploy on a deep recon mission out to a star called Zeta Reticuli. And anyone who follows UFO conspiracy theories knows all about Zeta Reticuli. It's supposed to be the home of the alien Greys. And of course, in the progress of the book, we find out that things aren't exactly what they seem.
That's great. Okay, so folks, I've read the book. I was given an advanced review copy. You're going to want to get this book. Let me just say, one of the things I appreciated most is how you interwove the history of UFO myth and the plot line of your book. I liked it, and I want to tread a little carefully because I know there may be some people listening who it's not myth to them. They do believe these things happen. Yeah, and I try
to be respectful of that.
Yeah, and I don't want anyone to misunderstand me either. But I just, for lack of a better term, I appreciated the way that you interwove the two ideas, the myth idea and the plot line of your actual book. That was really, really well done.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, okay, so let's talk about Mark Hunter for a few minutes, mm-hmm. Your main character. I liked him, not just because he was Navy, but I did like him a lot. I thought you captured well the struggle of putting a disparate team of different operators together into one cohesive unit, or mostly cohesive unit. Was he patterned after anyone, or just a figment of your imagination?
Somewhere in between. Many, many, many moons ago, I was in the U.S. Navy. I was not a Navy SEAL. I was a hospital corpsman. I was the guy that everybody called Doc. I did have a friend who became a SEAL, and with an interest in military history, I've had this very long-term fascination for the SEAL program. Back in the 90s, I wrote it was not science fiction. It was a very lightly fictionalized historical series called SEALs, The Warrior Breed. I didn't come up with that title. But it was basically an account of starting with the UDTs in World War II and going up through the SEALs in Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan. So with all the research I did for that series, I was pretty solidly grounded in the SEALs, who they are, how they think, and so forth.
That's good. So about him specifically, and actually, and the members of his team, did you, when you started sitting down and writing or hashing out what your synopsis was going to be before you started writing, was it like, okay, I've done this research on SEALs, I know SEALs, so a SEAL is a no-brainer for the main character, or was it the SEAL is a no-brainer for the character and I'm going to draw on my knowledge of SEALs to make him who he is?
The latter, I think.
Okay.
I try not to have the cardboard stereotypes. This is the starship captain. This is the Navy SEAL. Those are markers, but they're not defining the person. And like any good writer, I try to get into the person behind the facade.
Yeah, and I, for one, appreciated the character development. I know the listeners will too. So speaking of character development, and I hope I don't butcher their name too much, but the Zinti really impressed me. I don't want to give anything, you know, spoilerish away about what they do in the book, but can you, so that when people listen to this after they've read the book, talk to me about the character development of the Zinti, the pill bugs. How did they come about?
Okay. If I have any claim to fame as a science fiction writer, it's my alien aliens. I personally believe that when we meet beings out there, and we will, they are going to be so different from our notions of what aliens are now today from TV and so forth. One of the driving issues for Solar Warden is, you know, everybody's familiar with the little alien grays, 3 foot tall, big heads, big black eyes, staring at you out of the cover of Stryber's Communion.
Absolutely.
I have a problem with those. I believe in alien life. I do believe that UFOs represent some sort of phenomenon out there. But I find the grays to be entirely too human for comfort. You know, one head, two arms, two legs.
Yes,
two
very, very convenient.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And too many of the aliens that are reported look like people in rubber suits, like on Star Trek. So when I write about a genuinely alien species, I try to get into the mindset that's probably leaves me a bit insane at times, but I really try to look at the universe from as radically alien a point of view as I can. And trying to come up with a different point of view for all the different aliens I write is really a challenge.
I believe it. Okay, so I think what listeners will gather as they read this book is just the wealth and the depth of your imagination and your character development. So speaking of that imagination, you've written 20 different series of books, each with its own world building. What's it like to world build for a new series like Solar Warden?
Well, for me, the big challenge is always getting the science right, especially with Solar Warden. I was kind of given the background that, okay, we have anti-gravity, which is really tricky to think about in a strictly scientific way. The other thing I try to do is to avoid treading territory that other writers have covered or that I've covered in those 20 previous series. It's tough to balance things. Something like anti-gravity, any technological development like that is going to have so much impact on so many other technologies. If you have anti-gravity, you de facto have free energy. There's just no way around that. One thing leads to another, and I do try to capture that. Overall, though, I find world building to be a lot of fun. I mean, what other profession lets me create these vast star-spanning civilizations and then destroy them?
Right, right. You're basically living out every, at least boy's dream. okay, so that's really good to hear. And good to kind of get an idea of how that goes. So now let's switch to your writing name, Ian Douglas. Mm-hmm. That is obviously not your real name. Nope. So I know Ian Douglas has his name on more than one series. Solar Warden is not the first one with that name, right, by any stretch. So how did that name come up, and how do you pick which name is attached to the next series?
Ian Douglas came about. I had just finished a military SF series back in the early 90s called Warstrider, a 6-book series. It was under William H. Keith, and it was fairly well received. I actually had a chance to go to New York City, and I sat down with a really great guy, my editor for that series, called John Douglas. And we went, you know, I was able to pitch the next series, which became, this isn't the official name, I call it Marines in Space. The first book was Semper Mars. And it was about basically the future of the U.S. Marine Corps in space. So he liked the idea. He bought it. But he said I would really need a pseudonym. And the reason was that book buyers throughout the industry tend to look at previous sales. And if they see a particular author has just finished a series of 6 books, and now he's starting another one, they're going to assume that this is book 7 in the old series. And subsequent books, subsequent titles don't sell as well. So they're not going to order as many books. And it's pretty much a built-in guarantee of failure if you just keep writing book after book after book in the same name. So he asked me to pick a pen name. I chose Ian Douglas, the Scottish form of John Douglas, partially in homage to him. Also, by coincidence, had my daughter Heather been born a boy, his name would have been Ian Douglas. So
that is really fascinating to learn how you came up with that. That's, I know a lot of science fiction authors try to pay homage to someone who has been instrumental in their lives or careers. Sure. It's really neat that your editor, is he still the editor, or is that from just that series?
He moved on several years later. Okay. He was at another house. I don't remember which one. I'm not sure where he is now.
Well, it's really nice to hear that he's forever, I guess, immortalized, as it were. I mean, your books are going to be in print for a long time, so he'll always be there, I guess. Okay, the Alien Secrets, we're recording this for those who may be on their way crawling out of the pandemic. We're recording it still very much in the pandemic. Mm-hmm. How has launching and releasing Alien Secrets been different than releasing a previous novel that you've had or a series?
Well, this is the first time I've ever been interviewed on a podcast. The new series. That's the one big difference I can think of. The pandemic hasn't really affected my end of things because I always stay locked up at home, locked away in my office upstairs, typing away from early in the morning to late at night. What's the big difference? So I'm sure there are differences on the publishing end, but I'm not really privy to those.
Okay, that's good to know. Do you do radio interviews, or do you have phone cons with editors of magazines and stuff to get the word out about previous books and this one? Or is really this all a new thing for you?
Like I say, it's the first podcast. I had one radio interview many years ago, and it was a complete disaster. I don't think the interviewer had read the book.
Oh.
And kept asking me for, you know, what was your character's motivation? And I'm saying, to get to the end of the book.
It was on page 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand. I'm definitely, I know sometimes I don't always get to read the whole books before I do the interview, but I did. I was up late last night making sure I got through yours.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, and it was a good book. I can't say it enough, listeners. You got to get this book.
I can add that I used to go on the science fiction convention circuit. Nowadays, I go to Confluence, which is my little local, very small literary con here in Pittsburgh. And that's about all I do anymore. I like meeting the fans, but at some point I had to look at it and say, well, if I take the entire weekend and go invest the money to attend the con and all of that, how many books am I actually going to sell that I wouldn't sell otherwise? 3? 4?
Right.
I'm actually better off staying at home writing.
Yeah, so. I understand. The best promotion for a book is book 2, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're recording this, like I just said, during the coronavirus pandemic of 2020. Do you think a situation like that will ever end up in one of your future stories, or has it, and I just missed it, in one of your previous books?
Well, as a matter of fact, COVID-19 does sneak into book 2 of the Solar Warden series, so you haven't seen that one yet. And I agonized about whether to get into that or not. I didn't want it to appear that I was taking advantage of a really tragic global situation. You know, it's not a matter of trying to be topical to make a few bucks. On the other hand, as I said, Solar Warden is set in the present day. And so could I write a book set in the present day and not mention, at least in passing, the pandemic? So I had to take some guesses, because obviously this book isn't going to be out for quite a while,
right?
And by then we hope the pandemic will be long gone, but you know, we can't really say. I had to make some informed guesses there, but yes, I did. At the very end of the book, the team comes back from their latest mission and finds out, oh, they had a global pandemic here while we were gone. And there's just kind of a hint, a possibility that maybe aliens had something to do with it.
But naturally. Again,
of course, why bring it up? But again, I'm not trying to just be topical for the almighty dollar.
Well, I would appreciate that, as I'm sure anyone would. We wouldn't want to just capitalize on someone's loss. But
right.
I can see your point about it being written in the present day. Of course it has to mm-hmm. deal with present circumstances. Well, speaking of the next book and the rest of the series, what can you tell us about Mark Hunter? What will he be doing in the next novel, without of course spoiling anything in the first one? What's still in development? What's already down? What's Mark mm-hmm. Hunter doing?
Well, book 2, which I call Alien Hostiles, that one takes the team to a different star, to the star Aldebaran, and they're investigating the possible connection of the Nazi Third Reich, World War II, with aliens interfering with Earth's history. That's pretty much what that book's about. Book 3, I haven't laid out in great detail yet, but I'm thinking that probably Hunter and the team will be working here on Earth, because there's obviously an alien conspiracy to infiltrate governments on Earth.
Sure. I think that's great. You've just for the listeners, the second mission is alluded to almost from the beginning. So there's no spoiler there. You're going to read it very early on. I'm looking forward to reading that story. So just a quick question about pen names before we get to a reading from you. Does your family, I met your wife earlier today, does your family ever call you by the wrong name, or do, when fans say the pen name in public, do you greet them as such, or do you forget who you are?
I like to say that I wake up in the morning and I really don't know who I am today. I have to think about it. No, people don't usually call me by my pen names. If somebody were to say, hey, H.J. Riker, I'd respond. If we have the time, I do have a story to tell.
Please.
And that, this was at Confluence, the local con I mentioned. I was the guest of honor there once a few years ago. And they had me go up on stage and talk during the opening ceremonies. So I walked out on stage and I'm kind of pretending I'm smoking a pipe and say, I'm sorry, William H. Keith couldn't be here today. I'm H.J. Riker. Riker,
nice.
Riker is the pen name for my military histories.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of presenting this persona of a somewhat stuffy professorial sort. And I'm talking about H.J. Riker and what he's written. And then I interrupt myself with this kind of crude, vulgar, bombastic guy named, Robert Kane. Now, Robert Kane was the pseudonym for a men's action adventure series I did many, many years ago. It was all action. It was a potboiler. It was about an intelligent, self-aware robot named Cybernark that went out after drug lords. So Robert Kane interrupts H.J. Riker, and they get into an argument on stage. And they're going at it, and then they get interrupted by this kind of cultured Scottish burr, and that's Ian Douglas, telling them that neither of them knows what they're doing. And they get into a three-way then, and then decide they have to go inside and bring William H. Keith out, only he doesn't want to come out. And he's stuck away inside, and he thinks he's Isaac Asimov trying to write 500 novels.
Wow.
And it kind of ends in a... I think what I did is I grabbed myself by the collar and dragged myself off stage.
So that's cool.
That was about the strangest conjunction of multiple personalities in my life.
So we can add actor to your list of accomplishments.
Oh, hi, laddie.
Nicely done. Okay, so as you know, I ask guest authors to read a little from one of their books. I understand you're doing that for us today. What do you have?
Well, I have an excerpt from Chapter 1 of Alien Secrets, if you'd like to hear that.
That sounds great. Go ahead.
Okay. So just for warning, we won't have too much flying in space here. This is while the SEAL team is actually on a mission in North Korea. We all remember when North Koreans were setting off nuclear weapons and collapsing mountains and using slave laborers to clean out radiation contaminated caves and all of that. So Hunter is part of a SEAL team monitoring all of this from a nearby mountain. Hunter and the other seven men of his squad were spread out along the slope, all of them invisible under their ghillies, all of them armed. The U.S. Navy SEALs were very, very good at this sort of op. Below, the prisoners were being led into the gloom of the open tunnel mouth. Satellite imagery had suggested that the North Koreans were using slave laborers from Hwasong to clear out collapsed tunnels. If the leaked radiation was bad up here, it must be 10 times worse down there, a death sentence for men forced to work in those depths for more than an hour or two. Got anything, Colby? Hunter asked. Negative, Skipper. Chit-chat between the command post and a forward bunker. Hold it. Someone's yelling. Hunter's spine prickled at that. Had they been discovered? Commander, Taylor whispered with sharp urgency. What you got, Taylor? Sir, what in the everlasting bleep is that? Hunter rolled on his side, turning to look. Something was emerging from behind the crest of their hill. Oh my God! A flying saucer. There was no other term for the thing. At least 60 yards across, its surface gleaming silver, it hung in the leaden North Korean sky effortlessly and soundlessly, drifting slowly against the wind. Hunter had been a Navy SEAL for 12 years now. He knew intimately the aircraft, both of the United States and of other countries. This was something new. Hunter raised binoculars and let the autofocus sharpen the image before pressing the trigger button for the high-def video. It was tough to get the entire craft in frame all at once. He zoomed back so that he was getting more than a vast curved mirror floating overhead. Video of a real, live, honest-to-God flying saucer. The boys back in Yokosuka weren't going to believe this. He saw something breaking the polished surface, a kind of window or transparency, wider than it was tall. There was white light spilling through. Silhouettes. They were backlit, and Hunter could see no details at all. No, that wasn't true. One shadow looked distinctly human, though it was nothing more than a shadow. The other shapes were smaller, shorter, with large heads. The human shape raised a hand. It was waving at him.
Very nicely done. Well, we got a little bit of space stuff there.
A little bit.
Yeah, folks.
And we come back to that flying saucer at the end.
Yes, we do. And so, folks, I can personally attest to the fact that this is a really good book. I really think you ought to get a hold of it. Bill, I've really enjoyed our chat today. In the final few minutes we have, tell people how they can get a hold of you and your writing.
Okay. Well, sorry to say I'm not active on social media. For a guy who lives and breathes far future technology, I'm something of a techno illiterate. I do have a website at whkeith.com. There is a Wikipedia page about me, so you can look me up there. You can find my Ian Douglas books through harpervoyager.com. Just follow the author link, and under I, you'll find me listed with Isaac Asimov. So I feel like I'm in very good company there.
That's true.
Other than that, go to your local bookstore when they reopen, or your favorite online bookseller or a library, and you'll find me.
That sounds great. So, folks, I'll link to all of this in the show notes at the main Buzzsprout page. Thanks for being my guest today, Bill, and thank you all for listening to this episode. Take a look at Bill's Ian Douglas books wherever you buy your books, and be sure to subscribe to the Coffee in Space podcast. I'm Dan Smith, and I can't wait until we meet again over a cup of coffee in space.